So I'd like to speak this evening from Srimad Bhagavatam, and I'll just continue from where I left off. I've been speaking in sequence on the verses of Srimad Bhagavatam, and we're going to be reading from Canto 3, Chapter 27, which is entitled Understanding Material Nature. Is this a conversation between Lord Kapiladev and Devahuti? And just to help appreciate the subject matter a little bit, the context a little bit, its relationship with Bhagavad Gita. Kapiladev teaches Sankhya Yoga. And Sankhya literally means to count. And in practical terms, it's categories of matter, categories of spirit. We belong to the category of spirit. And then further processes of meditation, further processes of devotion in the realm of spirit. That's Sankhya. In Bhagavad Gita, there's three Sankhya sections. The first instructions of Krishna to Arjuna, chapter 2, Sankhya. Krishna says it. I've described Sankhya, now I'm going to describe Bhuti Yoga. So, matter and spirit, those verses, where the soul is in the category of spirit, and then there's matter that is different than who we are. That's the Sankhya section 1. Now there's chapter 7, very short, where Krishna says to Arjuna, there's Bina Prakriti Ashtada, the eight separated material energies. Aside from that, Aparayamitas Tonyam Prakriti Vidime Param. There's Para Prakriti and Bina Prakriti, and Krishna's the controller of both. That's another very short section. And for the most part, chapter 13 is also a Sankhya section. And the message of the Srimad Bhagavatam, Prabhupada makes it very clear in the purport, is taking that message of chapter 13 and expanding. And that's something of the relationship between Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. Bhagavad Gita is undergraduate and Bhagavatam is graduate study. So in undergraduate study, 2 plus 2 is 4. And in graduate study, 2 plus 2 is 4. Doesn't change. But the application of 2 plus 2 equals 4 becomes more complex or subtle or something. So the Bhagavatam isn't teaching something different from Bhagavad Gita, but it's taking that subject matter and going more deeply with that subject matter. Having a proper understanding of our circumstance, that is, we're spirit implicated in matter. And on the one hand, we want to become enjoyers of matter. That's why we're here. We're striving like anything. Since time immemorial, living entities are trying to become enjoyers of matter in different ways. It comes under different names and different eons and histories of mankind. But it's the same thing, trying to enjoy matter in different ways. And that's And the language of Bhagavad Gita, that's fruitive activity. Doing something to get something. Fruitive activity. And that something that one wants is, well, it's an object which I then try to be the enjoyer of. So the Bhagavad Gita is teaching us we're imitation purushas. The whole material circumstance is we want to be God. We want to be the enjoyer of God's property. That's how we want to be God. And one way to do that is just ignore Him. Atheism. Or, I'm not sure, that's agnosticism. And then theism is the beginning of where one accepts there is a proprietor and he's the enjoyer. And then I should enjoy, and according to theistic conduct, so the spirit remains the same, be the enjoyer. But be a religious enjoyer, but be an enjoyer. Or don't, just be an enjoyer. That's karma. And after enough lifetimes of doing that, one may realize I'm not having fun. The enjoyment that I expected is mixed with misery. And even the enjoyment isn't lasting, and it's not substantial, and I'm not feeling satisfied even when I'm enjoying. And so then one may turn to, or by frustration, one may turn to termination, liberation, moksha. Or, far more rarely, it may happen by religious processes becoming more and more and more concerned about finer and finer subject matters, like, you know, if there's life in heavenly planets, if my consciousness is more in the mode of goodness, still driven by passion, but more in the mode of goodness, my interest to achieve position in the heavenly region, a little light goes on and says, well, wait a minute, if there's me enjoying here and me enjoying there, there's something that's enjoying. There's something that's me, something that's enduring beyond the temporary. This circumstance, that circumstance, or something. What am I doing for the well-being of the soul? Recently I conducted a visit to the yatra and visiting places in South India. One of the places was Madurai. There was one of the Pandya kings. I forget the Pandya king's name. Devabrata, I think. Anyway, whatever his name was. He was traveling about something like what Lord Ramachandra did, incognito, so people wouldn't know who he was. Just get a sense of how people are doing in his kingdom. Was there difficulty? How were they feeling? And so forth. He was doing one of those. And in the course of his moving around, he heard of a great sadhu who was living under a tree in his kingdom, not in the near the palace, but some remote area. So he thought that he'd go see the sadhu. And when he met the sadhu, he felt this is genuine sadhu. And so he approached him and said, "My dear sir," not in his royal attire, just a regular citizen, "can you please give me some instruction that I can ponder and become spiritually benefited?" And the sadhu responded with a question rather than giving an instruction. Because he had asked for something I can ponder, so it was something to ponder. Something to the effect that the sadhu said, a man, lives his life in such a way that he works very hard so that he can supply for his family and at the end of the day enjoy with his family. A person works when they're young and filled with energy to take care of their necessities when they're old and the body is infirm. What activity is to be done today to take care of the needs of the soul after this body is finished? So, because of the regard that the king had for the sadhu, he took it very seriously and he was pondering the question and went back to his minister and asked his minister what his thoughts were on this subject. And he said, it's a very deep, profound subject. And anyway, there's more to the story. I'll tell the rest of the story. The minister said, this is such an important question that I suggest that you conduct a grand festival. Invite all the holy people and all the sages and all the learned wise people in your entire kingdom. And let's have a festival discussing this question. So the king said, this is a very good idea. You're a good minister. So he called for a festival. And the minister had said, let us make an arrangement where a cloth filled with pieces of gold will be suspended from the pole in the middle of the royal assembly. And whoever is the successful person prevailing over all of the other learned persons, then there will be some sign to show this bag of gold will become the property of the successful debater. We'll know by providential arrangement somehow. So that was done. Any of you know this story? Vishnu Chitta, or sometimes said Chittur. He lived in a place far from Madurai. And he was very simple, a brahmana, a very simple man. His occupation, his livelihood was, he had a garden, although he was a brahmana. His garden was for growing flowers and tulsi for the deity of Vishnu in the vicinity. And that's what he did. His happiness was one each day at the proper time for the worship of the deity. He would bring his very, very special garland for the deity. He was very devoted, very simple, not conflict, no primitive activities for this man. He was very pure and devoted to his deity. So he had a dream, and in the dream, the deity in Madurai, the royal deity of the royal family, appeared in his dream and said, "You should come and participate in this presentation, this debate." And in his dream, Vishnu Chitta said, "I don't have a qualification. I'm a Brahmin, but I'm not learned like all these people the king has invited. And what would I say?" And Lord Vishnu said to him, Don't worry, I'll give you the words to say. Just go. My wife. Anyway, it's nice. He went and spoke eloquently, and the bag of gold fell at his feet, and everyone understood, including the king, that he was speaking the conclusion of Vishnu Bhakti. This Vishnu Chitta became one of the Alvars. The king placed him on top of an elephant, the royal elephant, the biggest of all the royal elephants, and when it took him in procession through the streets of Mathura. And the deity of Lord Vishnu of the royal family was so pleased to see his devotee being honored in this way. He appeared on the back of Garuda. The deity appeared on the back of Garuda, hovering above the royal procession. And Vishnu Chitta had a particular relationship and parental affection. So he was very concerned for the protection of the deity. Ordinary people seeing this spectacle in Kali Yuga, they may think bad things or say bad things or make offense, and he didn't want the deity to be harmed or any difficulty to come to him, so he started spontaneously composing prayers in Tamil language that were glorification, seeking protection of the deity, seeking protection of the deity, seeking protection of Lord Vishnu. And there were bells hanging by the side of the elephant. So he took one bell and another bell and started clanging them like cartels. Very, very beautiful. But the reason for speaking this is it connects with, on the one hand, the position of the Brahmana, who is completely detached. Completely detached. Completely detached from any worldly thing, but fully attached to the Supreme. And on the other hand, this is what the sage was saying to the king, is what are people doing for that ultimate well-being of the living entity? We do things for our temporary well-being, and temporary well-being, and temporary well-being. What about the ultimate well-being? What is being done about that? Do people think about that? What should be done? So the lesson of attachment to the Supreme, Chapter 5, Bhagavad Gita. Attachment to the Supreme is the principle of detachment from matter. And how that connects with this is, Sankhya certainly teaches detachment from matter. Here's matter, here's spirit, we belong to the category of spirit, be detached from matter. Easier said than done. And that's this section that we're reading is Devahuti, after hearing this wonderful explanation, basically says easier said than done. She says it a little more detailed, but that's the essence. The living entity. Well, the message for this evening is there's two two dimensions to her question. One is because the living entity somehow or other has become implicated in matter, even if you have knowledge of the distinction between over there is matter and we're in the category of spirit, knowledge in Vedic culture is followed by detachment. Jnana Vairagya. It's a natural couplet found in all of Vedic wisdom, especially the Jnana Kanda section of the Vedas, the Upanishads and so forth. Knowledge and detachment. Knowledge and detachment. However, the living entity has been implicated in matter since time immemorial, even we may have knowledge. The the same cause that has brought us to be implicated in matter is going to make its way into our consciousness again. Even you may experience some detachment through knowledge. Knowledge alone is not enough. Knowledge is a byproduct of bhakti. So the knowledge that comes from bhakti is also important. We have to know what's what. We have to know we're in the category of spirit, not matter. We have to know there's a supreme spirit. We have to know those things. Otherwise, how can you properly engage in devotional service? But knowledge alone is not enough. The essence is bhakti. So this is where something that I puzzled over, like a lot, is how Sankhya Yoga connects with devotional service. Because the large part of Sankhya Yoga, even the sections that are there in Bhagavad Gita, or what to speak of these mammoth, detailed, elaborate descriptions of the unfolding of creation by, you know, a subtle energy unfolding into a grosser energy that then unfolds into another grosser energy, and you get, you know, the elements of creation. In fact, chapter 26, it's 72 verses long, and it's all this really complicated. I mean, unless you're really keen on technology, it's really puzzling. You know, just want to finish reading that and go on to something else, because it's, how does this fit together with that, fit together with that, fit together with that, fit together with that? We're not used to going through that kind of analysis. And that's a very substantial part of what Sankhya is. You know, in chapter 7, Bhagavad Gita is these 8 separated material energies. But going to the Bhagavatam, it is not just these separated material energies, it's really, you know, a zoom lens going into the whole thing, and how this creates that, and then you wiggle over here, and then wiggles that over there. It's like this technology. And if you wanted to be a creator, if you wanted to be Lord Brahma, you'd have to know that technology. It's cause and effect on the material side. And even in terms of bringing things into being, and once you know how to bring things into being, your Lord Brahma, then you know how to create the field of fruit of activities for the living entity, because behind the activity there's the soul and there's the consciousness of the soul, and my idea of happiness is this, so you wiggle this over there to get that over there. It's just fruit of activities program. But it's all set up. So what does that have to do with? Because Lord Kapila Dev is an incarnation of the Supreme Lord. He's not just going to teach analysis of matter. There is the analysis of matter, but it's far more than that. It ends up in devotional service. How do you get from analysis of matter to devotional service? And moreover, these are questions I've pondered. Moreover, this is Satya Yuga. And Satya Yuga processes meditation. Dhyan Yoga. Yeah. Kritaye. In the Satya Yuga, the process of achieving perfection is meditation. So how do you go from analysis of matter to meditation to devotional service? Because he's not going to teach anything other than devotional service. But it's a Satya Yuga version of very refined intelligence, understanding details of matter and how it fits together, and then just read the conclusion at the end of chapter 26, verse 72, like this long description. Prabhupada writes really simply, The analytical study of the elements of material nature, 26, and the concentration of the mind upon the super soul, that's the meditation part, are the sum and substance of the Sankhya philosophical system. The perfection of this Sankhya yoga culminates in devotional service unto the absolute truth. So in addition to the zoom lens picture of the fundamental principles of material nature, because that's the title of chapter 26, then comes this concentration of the mind upon super soul. That's what's introduced at the beginning of chapter 27. It does it through means of metaphor, or at least it explains the principle by means of metaphor. Metaphor is when something that's known and you wish to explain to somebody something that's unknown, you use metaphor. Like that which is known, is something like this. Is so good as because obviously there's going to be some dissonance. It's not this is that. It's like that. It's like this. To explain which we're not, but it's explained by way of metaphor. Feel it to table routine. By the way, in this section, there's some instructions for householders of how to be in the world. Know that your spirit soul from matter, but you're doing your duties from matter. And the probe is purported. And then how to matter, and then how to see other living entities. This one that comes in a lot in the meditation process, chapter 6, Bhagavad Gita. And executing devotional service, one has to see every living entity equally. Do you see every living entity equally? I struggle with that one because there's a Christian teaching that's similar. So when I was growing up, love thy neighbor as thyself. And how do you do that? Because some people are really nasty. How do you see every living entity equally? It's easy to say. Regard every living entity equally. But we have our modes of nature, and they have their modes of nature, and sometimes they don't match. So it means going beyond the modes of nature that rule the world. Without enmity towards anyone. Yet with anyone, surface of water, a pot of water reflected on the wall. You can know the presence of the sun and you can meditate on the sun in that way. And then the next verse says, similarly, living entity is implicated through the medium of Paul's ego. The self-realized soul is thus reflected, you know, like the light coming through the sun reflected upon the wall. The living entity, similarly, is reflected first in the threefold ego. That's the modes of nature. Some have this kind, some have that kind, some have the other kind. The living entity, there's no, without living entity, there's no false ego. But the false ego is not the living entity. And similarly in the body, senses, and mind. The presence of the soul can be understood by inference because there's animation of all those things. An animated false ego and an animated by body, mind, and senses. It's taking, you know, the chapter 26 and moving it into the meditation phase. And so then he describes, Kapilade describes the Devahuti, that there's a necessity of knowledge detachment and devotion to the Supreme. The devotion to the Supreme can be strengthened by meditation upon the Supreme, which we can do even when we're moving about. Like, you know, understanding, let's put it, just take an Ishopanishad example, understanding the proprietorship of everything. Isavashamidam sarvam. Anyone not familiar with that verse? Isavashamidam sarvam yatkincha jagatyam jagat. The indication is, if one recognizes, putting it simply, I'm here for a while and then I'm gone. And while I'm here, I recognize there's a proprietor. Not just, you know, the man that built the building and I'm paying my rent, but where do you get the ingredients? And so, you know, the ultimate proprietor of everything is the Supreme. That's the invocation verse. Everything comes from him, so it's his. And I'm passing through his place. So I recognize it's his place. I accept those things that are meant for my maintenance and don't accept other things knowing well to whom they belong. Purvaneva karmani. Knowing this, one can live happily for a long time. So even I'm going through my example is given so to illustrate it. I can think, I can meditate upon the Supreme even while doing my ordinary activities if I'm bringing my attention to his position as a proprietor. And that leads to detachment. It's knowledge in practice, not just in theory. Now, knowledge in theory is very common if people don't practice, but one can practice. And that's a form of meditation. It's opposing part of my, you know, practice, not what devotees do, but supposing my practice is I do my meditation on super soul every morning and try to make my mind calm and whatever that discipline is, I can't even describe it, but meditate on super soul, then I can carry that consciousness. That's the all-pervasive super soul is the proprietor of everything. And therefore I can live my life in a dutiful way, but detached, recognizing I'm simply performing my duty on behalf of the Supreme Lord, who is the proprietor of everything. That's what it's taking knowledge of matter and taking into the realm of meditation, which will then enter into the realm of devotion. Whole life of devotion, because that's what Sankhya is teaching ultimately. That's what we're going to hear, the unfolding, kind of slow motion unfolding of entering into the realm of pure devotional service. Devahuti, receiving that understanding from Kapiladeva. there's, in that process, there's, I'm not going to discuss in detail, but there's elaborate reference to the relief from false ego that one can achieve by what I've just described. You know, the false ego is according to the modes of nature. One acquires different types of false ego. Not just by knowledge, but by acting in relation to the Supreme, that false ego can be dissipated and eventually evaporated or dissolved. Kapilade says to Devamuti, wouldn't that be nice? Have your false ego dissolved and gone. And then, so Devahuti is going to ask, well, wait a minute. I'm paraphrasing, then I'll read what she actually says. Wait a minute. The living entity has been implicated in matter for so long. They're inextricable. How can you separate the living entity from matter? It's not just by saying, okay, I'm not part of matter anymore. We're implicated in matter. So knowledge alone is not enough. Is essentially what you say. It's not so easy to develop knowledge. Meditate on the super soul and you like, you're liberated. No more false ego. Again, this point she makes is the cause is still there. The cause may subside. But give it, let it wait around for a while and the cause is going to rise again. Because we're so deeply implicated in matter. So what to do? So then Kapila Dave, his answer is bhakti. You take shelter of the Supreme Personality Godhead and he'll lift you up. This deluding potency is under his control and he can lift you up. Just do it on your own strength and you're right, you can't do it. Knowledge alone isn't enough. I'm paraphrasing in a simple way. We'll just discuss a little bit more so you understand the direction things are going. Secondly, Prabhupada takes the opportunity, as do our predecessor acharyas in their commentaries, explain that the question that Devahuti is asking is indicative of voidism. So what do voidists say? Very similar to what impersonalists say. Voidists say there's nothing. So our idea of self is nothing. And the reality is there's nothing. So the implication of matter and spirit, this whole Samkhya exercise, all right, you want to separate matter from spirit or spirit from matter, what do you have left? You have nothing. So Prabhupada writes, and I'll help you go through it a little slowly, Prabhupada writes that the question Devahuti is asking, besides, you know, we've been implicated in matter so long, it's how do you get out of being implicated in matter? By knowledge alone is not enough. In addition to that, she is indicating, Prabhupada writes, a voidist conception. And that is, as I said, there's nothing. And it, you know, the misplaced consciousness, thinking that we're, you know, false ego, misplaced consciousness thinking that we're matter is what makes up life, but life is but an illusion. And you stop the illusion by, you know, no longer identifying with the implication with matter. But so, as far as they're concerned, there isn't even a soul. There isn't even matter. It's all an illusion. Really far out. You know, their idea of liberation is nirvana, nothingness. Literally. I mean, not like figuratively, but literally. That's where they want to go. They want to go to nothingness. One of the places I visit is China. And one of the necessities when you visit China is you have to know more than I knew before about Buddhism, because many people are Buddhist. Many people say they're Buddhist and really don't even know what that is. But some people know what it is. And the notion is, it's atheistic. There's no supreme. For that matter, there's no soul. For that matter, there's no matter. And the purpose of life is go to that state where there's nothingness. And even our idea of somethingness here is nothingness. We just think it's somethingness. But the enlightened soul, the word Buddha indicates one who has buddhi. And the Buddha who has buddhi indicates there's nothingness. And then there's a way of life to reach nothingness. It's simple language. Because, you know, different versions of Buddhism and stuff. So let me read what Prabhupada says here. After describing this process of meditation upon the super soul and living one's life in a conscientious, theistic way, with detachment, seeing equally all living entities, meditating upon the super soul, detached work in this world, one can achieve perfection. Of course, bhakti is mentioned several times, but exactly how bhakti fits in, well, it'll become more clear as we go along. So now Devahuti hears all this. This is text 17. All of that was background to get you to text 17. Sri Devahuti inquired, "My dear Brahmana," her son, Kapila, "does material nature ever give one release? Since one is attracted to the other eternally, how is there separation possible?" Purport, Prabhupada. Devahuti, the mother of Kapila Devi, here makes her first inquiry, although one may understand that spirit, soul, and matter are different. Chapter 26. Their actual separation is not possible, either by philosophical speculation or by proper understanding. This is, you know, the counter-argument. The spirit soul is marginal potency of the Supreme Lord, and matter is the external potency of the Supreme Lord. The two eternal potencies have somehow or other been combined. And since it is so difficult to separate one from the other, how is it possible for the individual soul to become the Brahman? By practical experience, one can see that when the soul is separated from the body has no real existence. And when the body is separated from the soul, one cannot perceive the existence of the soul. As long as the soul and the body are combined, we can understand that is life. But when they are separated, there is no manifested existence of the body or the soul. That's Buddhism. This question asked by Devahuti of Kapila is more or less impelled by the philosophy of voidism. The voidists say, so here's their assertion, consciousness is a product of a combination of matter, no mention of the soul, and that as soon as the consciousness is gone, The material combination dissolves, and therefore there is ultimately nothing but voidness. This absence of consciousness is called nirvana in Mayavada philosophy. So I've asked Buddhists, very interesting, you have the conception of reincarnation. What is it that's being reincarnated if this premise is there? Well, you get a whole variety of answers. None of them are very satisfying. Certainly they're not consistent with Bhagavad Gita's message. But, you know, it goes in the direction, the answers go in the direction of whatever it is that we think life is, until you reach the state of nirvana, that continues. So like combination of matter continues to the next combination of matter continues to the next combination of matter. What holds it together is not clear. I mean, that they don't have an answer for that one. Combinations of matter. Why would combinations of matter continue from the dismantling of one combination and it's kaput, it's over? And so the conscious self is absent in the concept of Buddhism. It has to be, because in the state of nothingness, how do you even know that you're in the state of nothingness? You have to be, there's a conscious observer. I'm in the state of nothingness now. But that doesn't exist. It's just nothingness. It's really far out. Devahuti goes on, text 18. As there is no separate existence of the earth and its aroma, that's like from chapter 26. Earth carries aroma, or water carries taste. Of course, the tongue is given to taste, but the taste is you're tasting something. You're tasting through the medium of water. There's a taste. This is the sense organ. Without fire, there's no heat. So how can you take heat away from fire? She's making the argument. How can you take taste away from water? How can you take aroma away from the earth? Do you separate those two things? What do you have? Similarly, there cannot be any separate existence of intelligence and consciousness. It's voidism. I mean, not that she has that conviction, but commonly, if someone takes seriously the message of nirvana, or for that matter, even moksha, you know, the Shankaracharya's conception of moksha, what's that? If all there is super soul, there's no jiva or atma and paramatma. That's a misconception. Shankara's teaching, all there is super soul. So if you're super soul, how do you get in this embarrassing position? And then, you know, how do you know that you're in this state of super soulness, super soul consciousness? And what are you conscious of? It's irrational. It's not a philosophy by which one can live. It's a philosophy that you can have a notion about, but it's not a philosophy that you can live. Interesting, mind-bending, but not practical at all. Anyway, so text 19, and then we'll end. Devahuti continues to ask Kapila, hence, even though he is the passive performer of all activities, that's like, you know, the self-realized soul, that's neutral because he realizes he's soul and he's doing, he or she are doing duties in this world in a neutral state, sense. Although they may be neutral, or the passive performer of all activities, how can there be freedom for the soul as long as material nature acts on him and binds him. So my consciousness may be, you know, nice, neutral, and whatever, but material nature doesn't stop. It's going to act. That's what she says in the next verse too. The cause hasn't stopped. Devahuti, in the purport, Devahuti poses the question that although one may speculate in many ways, where is the liberation as long as he is under the spell of material nature? And Prabhupada ends the purport of that paragraph. It says the answer is found in Bhagavad Gita 7:14. Only one who has surrendered himself unto the lotus feet of Lord Krishna. Mami Vye Prabhupadyante. 7:14 Bhagavad Gita. Can he be freed from the clutches of Maya? So now it's going to go from, by her question, the conversation is going to move into the realm of bhakti. Not just knowledge and I'm neutral, and material nature is acting, and I'm like, you know, I got lots of knowledge, so I can repel material nature. She's saying they're inseparable since time immemorial. It's interesting, but it's not practical. So it's going to take us, his answer is right off the first response. There's just a few more verses where she's asking these questions. But his first answer is through devotion. That which we're being introduced to, devotional service to Krishna. Devotional service to Krishna. Devotional service to Krishna is our process and we're given activities that are activities of devotional service, but that the real test of advancement in devotional service is that devotion increases, our attachment to Krishna increases. Like, you know, rising early and performing Mangalarti. So that's something we're supposed to do. It's a behavior. It's an activity. Or put our hand in our bead bag and start to chant the holy name and watch our mind go all over the universe. That's not what we're supposed to do. That's what happens. And it's the advancement is attachment to come to the stage where doing the activities that we do out of devotion, or cooking, or working, or whatever it is, cleaning, and raising your family, and doing your... It's the quantum of bhakti. And that's the essence. We do things to help increase bhakti. So it's like a diamond that needs to be polished, and the sparkle is naturally there. The activities that we're doing in devotion are to, it's like polishing the diamond. So within the heart already is not just devotion, but love for Krishna. Nitya Siddha Krishna Prema Sati Kapanoi. Shravanadi Shuddha Chitta Kariya Yudha, love of Krishna is already there. The activities of devotion have the potency to awaken fully that love of God. It's not the activities per se that we want. We want the love of God, we want the devotion. So it's different from, but similar to what's being expressed here. In Satya Yuga, it's this very, very detailed Sankhya followed by a process of meditation on Super Soul, carrying out one's duties while doing both of those things, but then moving into the house of bhakti. So the form in Satya Yuga is different. the essence is not. And it's important for us to capture the essence. And part of capturing the essence, it helps if you step out of your own autobiography, your own circumstance of life, and understand here this is Satya Yuga, and Devahuti is being taught, by the way, what starts this whole conversation is Devahuti's question, how to become free from my undue attachment to family life, because she has been with Kardava Muni for tens of thousands of years, serving him faithfully. And now that Kapila is there, he's gone. Tens of thousands of years, she's been serving him. He's very attached to him, and he's a perfect person. He's gone. And she's feeling, not like he died, but he's gone. He's not going to come back. And she goes to her son and says, my mind is bewildered. I know this is all temporary, and my knowledge is there, but I'm so disturbed. Please help me become free from this disturbance. She even says, I know it's your illusory Maya. So since you put it, you can take it. Please take it. Please remove this Maya. So all of this is the answer to that question. But it's going, in steps. So if we can understand the principles involved in this Satya Yuga process, we can then step back into our own life and apply the same principles, although the form is different. It's just a different yuga. But the principles are the same principles. Krishna spoke about the Gita specifically to dharma samstha anartaya, to reestablish dharma for Kali Yuga, because shortly after the Kurukshetra battle, Krishna's stay on the planet is over. So it's for us. And those same principles are further expanded in the Bhagavatam, the graduate study version. So to understand the principles and then apply the principles. Not just behaviors, but understand the principles and enter into the mood, the consciousness of devotion while conducting our activities of life. Progressively coming closer and closer to pure devotion to Krishna. Any discussion or comments?
While executing our services, we have to take decisions in every step.
Yes.
And because of the decisions, we may go to the liberated path or we may be implicated in the material existence.
Yep.
So, at that particular step, how we can come to know that whether I'm acting in policy or...
Contrary? Is that the word you use? Consciousness behind the decision is telling, or it's revealing. You've asked a question like this in the past, I recall. So it seems to be something that you either struggle with or want more clarity about or something. So we're going along the path of life, and here comes a decision. We have to go left or right or whatever. Um, enter into a reflective mode, mode of goodness, and then consider, you know, in that reflective mode, what's the higher purpose of life? And through this or through that, how is the higher purpose of life going to be best manifested? So, just that reflection in itself will these, the potential is there of revealing the modes of nature pulling this way as opposed to, you know, coming closer to Krishna that way. It may, it often, sometimes it does. Then, in that reflective mode, what are instructions? You know, examples from Prabhupada or examples from that which I've heard and read in scripture and things. So you're adding the light or illumination to that contemplation. And all of that can take some time. You know, really important decisions may take more time than other decisions, but we're making decisions all the time. If you go through that process that, you know, I'm describing, then it happens quickly. Just like driving a car. Somebody's learning to drive a car. Well, once you've driven a car for some time, it's you know, you don't even, the mental processes go very quickly. Anything, like anything, you know, somebody, I don't cook. Supposing I was asked to cook the Sunday feast, it'd take me forever. But somebody that's done it so many times, it doesn't take forever. Because you've done it so many times. Like that. You go through this process, and consciousness will follow that path very quickly. So initially, it may take a bunch of time, like these other examples. You're riding a bicycle. Once you've learned how to ride a bicycle, just get on the bicycle. You don't even think about it. I mean, those are motor skills, but in principle, it's the same. Something you've done so many times. So if in principle, there's a decision, you pause, and you go into this reflective mode, and you're addressing yourself to Super Soul, Krishna, please guide me. I want to do that which will bring me closer to you. And you, it happens very quickly if one is practiced at doing that. And then you may not have a clear idea, so you may just stay in that paused space for some time. But at some point, you can't stay paused forever. Some things require decisions, one way or the other. And so this is, I remember like 20 years ago, I wrote a little essay about this, that you make a choice. You have to make a choice. And some things you can postpone, but you have to make a choice. And the choice that you make, so you choose, you know, B instead of A, or A instead of B. You take the initial steps down A instead of B, or B instead of A. Looking for some indication from Krishna, you made the right decision, or you didn't make the right decision. And if you didn't make the right decision, don't remain attached. You retrace your steps and go back to the other one, or go back to maybe there's option C. But you take guidance from teachings and you know, Super Soul and those that you feel close to. One of my god brothers, very nice devotee, when he has described to me how he makes such difficult decisions. Something like 50% is praying, and or some percentage, a substantial amount of praying, a substantial amount of carefully considering instructions Prabhupada has given in areas like this, and then consulting God brothers and, you know, persons whose wisdom he values, and then make a decision. And there's always the recalibration or refinement or something, maybe even retracing. It starts with super soul, and then the next verse goes to the soul. First, but it's understanding the presence of super soul by that method, similarly. And then extends, once that is in place, it goes to the next one. The presence of the Supreme Lord can be realized just as the sun is realized first as a reflection on water. I used rays through the window, but reflection on water. And again, as a second reflection on the wall of a room, although the sun itself is situated in the sky. And the purport is speaking specifically about the sun. And then the next one is about the soul. Similarly, the self-realized soul is thus reflected first in the threefold ego. But without a soul, what's the ego? And then in the body, senses, and mind. Just like the Sankhya system of the unfolding of the elements. When the glance of Mahavishnu goes to Pradhan, and the soul and time energy are there, the Pradhan becomes agitated and it starts to separate out the elements. The first one is false ego. Before there's body, is there anything? There's living entity becomes influenced by false ego. And then there's bodies and minds and senses. It's secondary. The soul can be understood that way. Super soul can be understood similarly. And then you live your life. Soul, super soul, and matter. You can read the purpose then. Okay. Anything else? Bhagavad Gita's message, this is just a graduate study of Bhagavad Gita's message. Prabhupada, in these purports, Prabhupada is referring to chapter 13 verses, Prakriti Kriyamanani, and other verses. Kananam guna sangosya sadasat yoni janmasu, from Bhagavad Gita. The living entity experiences happiness and distress because of the living entity's attempt to be Purusha, being the enjoyer of matter. Purusha prakriti stoi bhute prakriti gan jan munan. So, this is taking that message of Bhagavad Gita and from Kapila Dev, taking it in more detail. Our basic problem is trying to be God. the material world is created. One of the purposes of creation is to provide the means for the living entity who wants the kingdom of God without God. They want to be the enjoyer of God's kingdom. And so this illusory realm is created where people think, I'm the king. At least I have my little kingdom within the bigger picture of creation. And I'm building my life is to build my little kingdom. And I'm the enjoyer of it. And I have people attacking to get, some control of my kingdom. And so I defend against it. The whole thing. But it's all illusory. And it speaks of this, again in metaphor, when one is sleeping, the sense of false ego that one has when awake is gone. We have another type of false ego operating. And then when the dream is over, that false ego goes to sleep. And another false ego takes over. We just vacillate between one illusory existence and another illusory existence. We don't know what illusory existence. Transcendence, our project is to enter into the realm of transcendence. So then, illusory existence has to be dismantled. Devahuti is saying it's not enough just to know that it's not for real. Because we're under the control of material nature. At the end of the day, or tomorrow, after we've finished our nice discussion about where spirit, soul, and matter, matter's acting. Knowledge alone isn't enough. So to be continued, Hare Krishna. Prabhupada, please.
Okay, you can pass it, Joe.